General Government Committee of the House. Welcome all of you. We have some work sessions this morning, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2154. Kara, you want to remind us?
Certainly. Let's do this. Is that the order they're on the agenda? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'm just in the wrong order. With you in a moment. House Bill 2154 enables the governor to assign county, city, and special district resources across jurisdictional lines if needed to respond to collapse or threat of collapse of structures. It authorizes the state fire marshal or his or her designee to manage resources when made available by the governor and provides for reimbursement of responding agency costs.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? I would entertain a motion. Representative Escobar.
Yes, we're on 2154, correct, Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move that we send it to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Escobar moves House Bill 2154 to the House with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? So moved, and I close the public or the work session on House Bill 2154 and open a work session on House Bill 2155. Kara, remind us of this one.
Madam Chair, may we look at 2154 and have someone carry the bill?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Or, excuse me. You know, it's my mistake. It actually has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So,
we are going to back out. I'm going to reopen. Can I do that?
Mm-hmm.
House Bill 2154 and
we need a motion that sends the bill to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Escobar, would you like to?
Yes, I'll
rescind. I think you need to rescind your.
I don't know if we have to rescind. I think once we make a motion to another motion, then we vote on that. Isn't that correct? To a supplement?
Linda just told us.
I think we could rescind the first motion and revote. Or suspend the rules to...
Okay. I think we need to suspend the rules. Madam Chair, I make a motion that we suspend the rules on 2154 and designate it to go to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
I don't think that's...
Referrals.
Okay. All right. Representative Escobar moves that we suspend the rules on House Bill 2154 and move that it be referred to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? So moved. Now I'm going to again close House Bill 2154 and open House Bill 2155.
And I again apologize for my oversight on that. 2155, excuse me, grants the governor more flexibility to assist local jurisdictions and make firefighting forces and equipment available in response to heightened danger of fire during a significant reduction of available firefighting resources.
Okay. Representative Witt.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2155 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Does that go to the Ways and Means?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Witt. Representative Witt moves House Bill 2155 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? So ordered. Representative Witt, would you like to carry this bill?
I'd be happy to.
Thank you. That's... be your first bill, and welcome. I'm closing public hearing on House Bill 2155. At this time, I am opening a work session on House Bill 2118. Kara, would you like to explain this one?
House Bill 2118 that you heard last week provides for permanent public access to State of Oregon publications, regardless of whether they are printed or posted on an agency's website. It creates a digital state document repository built on the existing hardware and software that the state now owns and operates. It causes the state library to create catalog records for all state documents, printed and electronic, and make that catalog available to all Oregon libraries. It further it reduces the number of copies of printed documents that state agencies and the Legislative Assembly are now required to provide to the state library.
Thank you. Members of the committee, I would like to invite Mr. Shepke to come up and sit in the chair and give me just a little guidance on how the state library will decide which libraries will be the repository libraries.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Shepke. I'm director of the state library. Madam Chair, currently the full depository libraries are in administrative rules, and the State Library Board is empowered to make those administrative rules. So were this bill to be enacted, the State Library would immediately begin an administrative rulemaking process.
Mm-hmm.
And the statutes give some guidance to the State Library Board about how to make that selection. That appears in on page 3 of the bill, in section 5. The current statute says the selection of libraries shall be based on the size of population served, geographic distribution, and the ability of the library to provide the public with access to these public documents.
Okay. Is there any provision that university libraries within the state would have more of those specific attributes?
Madam Chair, there's currently no guidance in the statute. I think the State Library Board is aware that the state documents are very important to our universities, that they use them in their teaching, and that they really value being full depository libraries. So I think the board is aware of that and would take that into consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Shepke. Does the panel have any, or the committee have any further questions? Thank you for your testimony. I think, members of the committee, because Representative Buckley had some specific issues around this and he is testifying in another committee, I am going to close the work session on this particular bill at this time, and we will bring it back later. I hate to hold it in abeyance, but there are issues around this. Yes.
There's also a potential fiscal impact on us, and we're unaware of that at this time. We haven't received that.
So we are going to. I'm going to close the public or the work session on that particular bill and save it for further discussion. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2125. Kara?
Yes. House Bill 2125 amends Oregon Revised Statute Chapter 657 regarding Indian tribes that pay unemployment insurance tax. It holds the Indian tribes to the same standards that are applied to local governments that pay unemployment insurance taxes for extended benefits.
Okay, thank you. Any questions on this one? I would entertain a motion. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Madam Chair, I recommend that we move House Bill 2125 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
No, we need a subsequent referral to revenue. I'm sorry.
We need a subsequent referral to revenue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we have a
then I'll retract that and we'll
make a recommendation that House Bill 2125 be moved to Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation.
And not the Revenue Committee?
Revenue Committee.
Okay, thank you. Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 2125 to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? So moved. And I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2125. We have a public hearings committee members scheduled on. Should I? Do I need to open them?
No.
On House Bills 2253, I have basically moved that to a later agenda item, and House Bill 2259, which I have also moved to a later agenda. Committee members, they'll come back, we'll talk about them, but I think today I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2488 and invite Kara to talk about this bill.
House Bill 2488 amends Oregon Revised Statute 814 to allow operators and passengers ages 21 and older to ride mopeds and motorcycles without using a helmet. As a little background, Oregon law currently requires all operators and passengers on motorcycles and mopeds to wear helmets. The requirement is a result of legislation referred to voters by the 1987 Legislative Assembly and passed in the 88 primary election. Oregon had a mandatory motorcycle helmet law between 1968 and 1977. Three states, Colorado, Illinois, and Iowa, have no helmet requirements. 27 states require helmets on specific riders, usually those under age 18 or 21, and 20 states, including Washington and California, require all motorcyclists to wear helmets. Presently, failure to wear a motorcycle helmet in Oregon is a Class D traffic violation, carrying a maximum fine of $94.
Okay, thank you, Kara. We have a number of people this morning who signed up to testify. I, as a courtesy, call folks who have come for more than 100 miles to the podium first, and unless there's a list that says they don't, and says there's a note that says they don't want to be called first. So I'm going to call Rex Jamison first, because he has come from a long ways.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm really not going to have a lot to say this morning other than...
Rex, would you mind giving your name for the record?
I'm sorry.
That's fine.
Rex Jamison. I'm with Douglas County Chapter of ABATE, and I'm the legislative representative for that chapter. I represent approximately 110 members. I'm here to speak for them this morning and ask for your support in passing this bill. I've lived in other states where there were no helmet laws and where there were helmet laws, and I can say from my own experience that I much prefer being able to choose when to wear a helmet and when not to. There are times when it's better, and there are a lot of times when it's not. In the summertime, when it's hot weather, helmets can be a real problem safety-wise, because they prevent you from being able to get rid of excess heat, which can cause problems with your vision and focus. I'm going to leave most of the time here for these other people who have prepared more than I have, and I just would like for you to give an open-minded attention to all of their testimony. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Jamison. Are there any questions, Mr. Jamison? Thank you for coming. Michael Boggs, Marion County.
Good morning.
How do you do?
And thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Michael Boggs. I'm a resident of Northeast Salem, Marion County. I have three children, five grandchildren. I'm an ordinary, average, everyday kind of guy, and I ride a motorcycle. I've been a professional in the mental health field for over 30 years. I've been a motorcyclist for over 40 years, and I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 2488. And the reason I am is primarily due to an equality issue. Our state has long supported freedom of choice for a number of things. In particular, say, a woman's right to choose what happens to her body between her navel and her knees. The problem here is that that same woman is not allowed the right to choose what happens from her neck up if she gets on a motorcycle. We have repeatedly affirmed that the dying in this state are allowed to choose the manner of their death. How is it that we, the living, are not allowed to choose the manner of our lives and what degree of risk we're willing to take? In other aspects of our lives in this state, we must be found legally incompetent or insane or criminally guilty before our rights to choose our behaviors are taken away from us. However, in the regard of a motorcyclist, they are prevented from exercising choice. They've never been found to be insane or incompetent, but are denied opportunity to exercise their own choice. According to health statistics, and we hear a lot about statistics in regards to these issues, but according to this health statistics, I am far more likely to die by medical malpractice than I am from motorcycle accident. I'm also far more likely to die, as the committee might notice, from the effects of obesity than I am from motorcycle accidents. And yet those who repeatedly oppose our position rarely offer suggestions that we close all pizza parlors and Burger Kings, though they are a source of great public health threat. The public burden issue is often brought up, that if helmet laws were repealed, if helmets were a matter of choice, nursing homes would be filled within 6 years with head-injured, long-lived, extremely expensive cases. And yet, if we step back, get away from the rhetoric, and take a look at what's really happening, it is heart attacks, strokes, the effects of age, a number of other causes that fill nursing homes. Nobody proposes that we outlaw the causes of those. Can't outlaw the cause of age, perhaps, but certainly heart attacks and strokes, secondary to diet and lethargy. Is the state likely to force diet and exercise on all of its citizens? Or will one sector of the community be forced to bear the burden? And it's consistently been a small segment of the population that's faced with the public burden issue. It doesn't spread across all members of society equally. My concern is that if there is to be a burden born, it be equally borne by all members in Oregon, not just the motorcyclists. Thank you for your attention. I'm available for any questions you might have.
Questions of Mr. Boggs from the panel? Thank you very much. Lisa Millay?
Millay?
I'm sorry.
Chair Berger.
That was close.
Well, I answer anything close. It's Lisa Miette.
I am. You even wrote it out, and I didn't get it right. Miette.
Good morning, Chair Berger, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Miette, and I manage the Injury Prevention and Epidemiology section at Department of Human Services. The department has a mission, and part of the mission is increasing safety among Oregonians. The department and the governor oppose this bill. So I'll talk about the reasons that they do. You have copies of my testimony and a couple of fact sheets. Motorcycle helmets have been found to be an effective injury prevention device. In fact, some research says that they reduce the risk of fatal head injury by as much as 40%. In 1998, and there's some history here that you may not be aware of, the Oregon Health Policy Institute convened an objective and balanced panel of experts that included riders, public health practitioners, and others to look at motorcycle laws and the health effects of motorcycle helmets. The group met together and reviewed published literature. They reviewed the trauma center data, and findings of the panel concluded with these 4 points. That the data indicate that helmets reduce the probability of head trauma, and they reduce severity of head injury. That there are no data indicating that helmets increase the probability of a crash. Available data indicated the following enactment of a universal helmet law, which require all riders to wear helmets, and the reductions in the number of head injuries and fatalities. And to the extent to which helmet laws increase the use of helmets and thereby reduce the incidence and severity of head injuries, helmet laws should reduce general health care costs too. So if we agree there's no debate over helmet laws work to prevent head injury, the debate comes down to the question of personal freedom and responsibility to choose to wear a helmet, and whether that's more important than the public responsibility to reduce injuries and save health care costs, prevent deaths, and save public funds. The case for requiring use of helmets as a public responsibility is strengthened by the knowledge that motorcycle riding is more dangerous than driving a car. A person driving a car or a person riding a motorcycle is 21 times more likely the number of deaths, I guess what I'm supposed to say, per mile traveled on a motorcycle is 21 times greater than deaths driving in a car. That's because the bodies of motorcyclists are more exposed to injuries from crashes. The only countermeasure that's available to a motorcyclist is a helmet. So we'd like you to consider that. It does reduce the probability and severity of head trauma. So healthcare costs is also a consideration when you're thinking about personal freedom to choose and public responsibility. When a person survives a head injury, many times they need 5 to 10 years of rehab. The upper end limits that have been spoken about for lifetime costs of rehab may exceed $4 million per person. You don't see a lot of that, that's correct. But in these cases, what happens is public funds are used to cover healthcare costs and expenditures through Medicaid and healthcare practice. And all taxpayers pay for preventable injuries in those cases. The Oregon people have clearly supported a helmet law in the past. Oregonians recognized the value of wearing motorcycle helmets when they approved existing law in a 1988 referendum. And the vote was passed by a 2-to-1 margin, 73% to 22%. And for these reasons, the department asks you to oppose this bill.
Questions?
I have a question, Madam Chair.
Yes.
The statement that helmets are the only countermeasure available to motorcyclists, wouldn't drivers of automobiles with a greater knowledge and understanding that motorcyclists are allowed to be on the road and that they should look for motorcyclists, wouldn't that be a countermeasure? And wouldn't another countermeasure be just to make it more difficult to actually obtain a license for an automobile? I rode a motorcycle for quite a long time. Currently I don't, but I proudly have the M on my license. And when you're riding a motorcycle, you are very aware that any accident could be very harmful. So you're hyper aware. Whereas people driving cars, we all know what people do when they're driving cars. Their attention's all over the place. So couldn't we come at this a different way? In other words, through the training of automobile drivers? And isn't that also a countermeasure?
Chair Berger, Representative Galizio.
Galizio.
I would agree with you that a multi-factored approach to reducing head injuries and injuries to motorcyclists is favorable, but that wouldn't exclude the use of helmets. That would include also teaching drivers to see motorcycles and how to respond when they see them.
Yeah. Can I follow up?
By all means.
Wouldn't it also be safe for drivers of automobiles to wear helmets?
Representative Berger, Rep. Galizio.
Uh-huh.
One of the most interesting facts in the injury prevention world that has just come out recently is the fact that headrests are nothing more than that, and they don't protect your heads from whiplashes that occur in car crashes. I don't know if helmets would reduce head injuries. I don't know if those studies have been done yet. One of the things that is being done in car crashes, though, is the increase in cars that now come with side airbag curtains, and there's probably going to be a new federal standard soon about headrests to make them truly functional in terms of protecting people's heads in car crashes.
Thank you.
Representative Witt has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lisa, do you have any data by any chance from some of the states that do not require wearing of a motorcycle helmet with regard to the number of deaths per mile traveled on a motorcycle as compared to Oregon?
Chair Berger, Representative Witt, I don't have that with me right now. I could certainly get that and have that sent to the committee.
Are you, Madam Chair,
yes.
Are you familiar with it at all with what might be a trend? Are they higher in the other states or lower or about the same? Do you know that?
Chair Berger, Representative Witt, let me look back and see what Troy is saying. He says he doesn't have any.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think, would like to have that information at some point. If you wouldn't mind, we would welcome that. We will be having further hearings, so there is time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the list, Jim Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Jim Anderson here today representing OSEP, which is otherwise known as the Oregon Chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. And as you might well expect, we are here today to oppose House Bill 2488. I will go through my testimony in pieces. I will not try to step on what the lady before me just said as far as repeating any statistics. You have being passed out to you copies of my testimony. I invite you to look through it. And a fact sheet that we put together to try to help you in making some of the determinations. And, Madam Chair, with your permission, I would like to address a question that was just presented by Representative Witt. If you could look, Representative, on the fact sheet, first page, first side, that is, and this was made two-sided, so the first side would be headed motorcycle helmet laws. And look down several lines, you'll notice the state of Kansas is highlighted there, and the death rate for motorcyclists rose 61% the year following the repeal of its universal health law. That helps you in determining the answer to your question. And I'm sure that other states would have statistics, maybe not quite that drastic, but for some reason that was extremely high, we feel, and other states may be lower. But I think in every case you would probably come across, you would probably find that the frequency rose in all cases. Madam Chair, I would just like to highlight some of the portions of the testimony, and read it into the record. The unhelmeted motorcyclists are three times more likely to suffer a traumatic brain injury, and nationwide taxpayers have paid between 60 and 80% of the cost caring for these injured riders over time. Motorcyclists repeatedly complain laws requiring the wearing of helmets when operating a motorcycle on public streets and highways violates their constitutional and or individual rights. In fact, in 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court held that a Massachusetts universal health law, helmet law, as not violating a motorcyclist's constitutional rights. All highway safety laws require individuals to act in specific ways. Failure to obey traffic laws result in serious risk to themselves and others. Motorcycle helmet laws are no different. State laws requiring motorcyclists to wear helmets have a direct impact on health care costs. Unhelmeted riders have higher health care costs because their injuries and many lack any form of health insurance. Average inpatient hospital charges for unhelmeted motorcycle accident victims are 8% higher than helmeted riders. Our organization views this as a common sense issue, and so did the people in the primary election when they passed this law into effect, which I may point out, for those other states that do not have this law on the books, it has not been presented to the people. It has been a legislative matter that has been taken up, and the legislatures in those states are the sole determinant as to what the law will be. In our state, however, the people have spoken. The proponents will argue that other motorists are operating automobiles using public roads, streets, highways, are not required to wear helmets, and that this requirement against them is unfair and unnecessary. We believe safety measures for automobiles have improved over time, and with the necessity to wear seat belts and to have children secured safely in approved restraints when in a motor vehicle. If the inclusion of helmet wearing for motorists would help, then that should be considered. But we do not feel that this is practical. Wearing helmets for motorcycles is a good public policy for this state, and we urge you to oppose this House Bill 2488. With that, Madam Chair, I would close, but I would point out again on the fact sheet that I gave to you on this, on the reverse side, one of the previous people testifying did mention about the restraints that a helmet or the encumbrance that a helmet gives them. There are three bullet points toward the top of the back side of that page that state the what a full coverage helmet provides them. And over time, these helmets have been changed. The early helmets for motorcyclists, I will agree, were an encumbrance. But today, they have full vision, and the sound issue is not there because over most motorcycle engines, other noises, car horns, can be heard. And this has been proven out in national safety tests. That, Madam Chair, I would close and stand ready for any questions.
Any questions of Mr. Anderson? Mr. Whitner,
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, do you have any data that would compare head injury rates of comparable accidents between automobiles and motorcycles?
Automobile to automobile, motorcycle to automobile.
Automobile to motorcycle.
Yes, we can get that for you, Representative. I don't have it with me, no.
Okay.
Thank you. Sure. We would welcome that.
I will try to get it for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions? No, thank you very much. I'm going to go to Jack Patrick. No, you're not going to testify. Okay, that's fine. Rick Mache. Okay, that's fine. I'm going to call in Lieutenant Gary Miller from Oregon State Police. Anyone?
Thank you very much. Chair Berger, members of the committee, for the record, I am Lieutenant Gary G. Miller, Assistant Director of the Patrol Services Division of the Oregon State Police. I've spent 27 years in the Patrol Services Division as both a field officer and a supervisor in Pendleton, Springfield, and Salem. I'm also a nationally accredited crash reconstructionist and have been since 1984, which essentially just means I've had a lot of training in areas of crashes and crash investigation. For the record, the Oregon State Police has a strong concern with House Bill 2488. The bill, as you've been told, would allow, regardless of age, people to not wear their helmets or over 21, I should say. The mission of the Oregon State Police is to promote and enhance transportation safety on state and interstate highways, and we believe that this legislation would not enhance transportation safety. You've already heard testimony from people today on reasons to oppose this bill. Rather than go into other reasons, we concur with their findings. I would tell you one thing that comes to our attention. We do a thorough job investigating crashes, and a fatal crash, we spend a lot of time at it. And so it's just a simple matter of resource allocation. If there's a fatal crash, it didn't need to be a fatal crash or a serious injury crash, and we didn't need to spend a lot of time. We could spend more time trying to prevent these crashes, these type of things. It's for these reasons and several others that we oppose this legislation. That concludes my testimony. Thank you for allowing me to testify, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Questions?
I have a couple. Is it mandated in Oregon that motorcycle owners, drivers, have insurance?
I'm not sure on that. I'd have to check back and find out if they were part of the liability insurance.
And
I can check back and find out for you.
Is it a law? We'll get back to that. I'm sure someone will answer that. And is it a law in Oregon that motorcyclists have to have their lights on when they're driving?
Chair Berger, members of the committee, yes, that is a law.
Okay. Can you think of any other requirements for motorcycles that might be different other than helmets and lights?
Chair Berger, members of the committee, off the top of my head, you know, they have to have additional training. They have to the endorsements of riding a motorcycle and then reading that type of information that go with that. I think they have to go in to the Department of Motor Vehicles, who could probably explain this better than I can, and demonstrate their ability. I don't know what additional knowledge tests they have to take, but I think there are some.
I hope that that will be answered in further testimony, exactly what the steps are to a motorcycle endorsement. It's been a few years since I've been on a motorcycle. Driven one. Yes. Representative Sunday.
Chair Berger, I have just one question. Presuming 2488 pass became law, 21-year-olds would not have to wear helmets. What would be the process for checking the age of passing motorcyclist? Would you pull them over simply to check how old they are? Are you authorized to do that?
Chair Berger, Representative Sumner, that's a very difficult position. One of the many reasons that the legislation is difficult for us is we will have a difficult time telling if somebody is over or under the age. We have the ability, if we believe, you know, we have a reasonable cause that they're violating law, we can make that stop. In this case, some people may be stopped that shouldn't have been, and others may not be stopped that should have been or should not have been. So your question is very good, and it's one that I can't answer very well.
In general, it would just simply add to your workload.
Chair Berger, Representative Sumner, I would agree with that.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I am going to finish with one page before I go on to another, and therefore call Pat Ryan.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pat Ryan, and I'm the membership director for Bike Pack of Oregon. and I'm unaccustomed to public speaking. My wife usually does that. In hearing the testimony here, I did pass out a sheet for you folks, and it addresses actually some of the issues that that I wanted to touch on today with regards to testimony that's already been given. With regards to initiative petitions, I'm sure that any of you members that have been in the legislature have had cause to both praise and curse the initiative petition process. The United States is a republic. It was set up that way so that the deliberative bodies at the federal and state level could be sent by the people and make those decisions there, and you're often circumvented and second-guessed, and you have my sympathy for that. But basically, of course, the police officer that spoke previously, the healthcare professionals that spoke previously, have a legitimate and caring interest in minimizing carnage on the road, and they see the effects of people that do indiscreet and stupid things, and they see that also from automobile drivers as well as motorcyclists, and they have yet, in all the years that we've been working to get our freedom of personal choice back, to present statistics that show that, as the question was asked earlier by a member of the committee, where are all the bodies stacked up like cordwood in emergency rooms, putting a burden on the rest of society. I myself have ridden motorcycles for 38 years. I am a subscriber to Motorcycle Consumer News, which is a periodical that pushes best practices. This last summer, I had the opportunity to purchase a motorcycle on eBay and found it to be in Savannah, Georgia. So I jumped on a plane and went out to Savannah, taking my helmet with me because some states are helmet required and some are not. It's typically my choice to ride on secondary and tertiary roads when I can, because I'm not really a big fan of freeways. However, in this case, it was freeways all the way back. I had work to do. And I rode through many states that had no helmet law requirement and a few states that did. And you know what? I wore my helmet in every one of those states because due to road conditions, weather conditions, what was going on, it was my judgment that my safety would be best protected by wearing a helmet in those circumstances. However, as Michael Boggs said earlier, to us, this is not about really at the core whether it's you can save one or two lives out of several million riders. This is about whether people have the right to choose how to live their own lives, and to the degree that the state, of course, has to legislate because, for example, car restraints for minor children. Of course, it's the state's responsibility to see to it that children are protected, because a lot of times they're designated primary care people, their parents, the foster parents, whatever the institution might be, does the work inadequately. And the state needs to be there to protect minor children. However, once you reach the age of an adult, I think, you know, regardless of the constitutional decisions or whatever, the basic concept, as stated by Justice Berger years ago, was the right to be left alone. And whenever the state needs to intrude, and often the state does need to intrude on people's private liberties for the good of the population, resentment is generated. And I did put a kind of a little example down here in the second to the last paragraph on the first page. There was a deal here in the state a few years ago about hunting bears and cougars with dogs. Now, it's my opinion, no, I don't have the statistics, that there are probably 20 guys in the whole state that hunt bears and cougars with dogs. Maybe 20 guys, maybe less. It's time-consuming, it's expensive, it requires a lot of training. But 200,000 people were angry, and they were writing to their legislators. And I spoke to a legislator from my county, and he actually asked his staff to check out where these complaints were coming from. Well, they weren't coming from these hunters. They were coming from people that lived in Eugene, people that lived in Portland, that were just, wait a minute, now they're infringing on my freedom again. And it wasn't that person's freedom, but it was their perception.
Of course, everybody remembers this whole thing with Dorothy English and the zoning laws, which has led now to the passage of Measure 37, and I applaud the legislature. In the last session, they did address this issue, and it made it to the governor's desk, and there was no further action taken. But if that had carried through, we might not have Measure 37 to deal with in this session. Going to the second page, I did a couple little quick ones last night. You folks have been very proactive and got us in front of the committee before I was really ready to get my presentation together. But studies actually have been done and are being done continuously about best practices for driving a car, and they're done on the racing circuits. And the current best practices in NASCAR is a helmet that's attached to the frame of the car and to the suit that the driver wears, and a 5-point harness. And if we mandated that every driver in the state of Oregon, indeed in the nation, wore that kind of gear, we could probably reduce fatalities by 40% or 50%, as these folks said. However, if you look at my second example, the crux of it comes down to the last paragraph. This was about skiers, and 15 million skiers that are on the slopes every year, there are about 30 fatalities, and people run head-on into trees. Most of them happen to be young men. And so if they required all these skiers to wear helmets at a cost of $30 a piece, around $460 million, they could save 11, possibly, of the 30 lives that are taken each year. But I argue that there's some point at which you may not get to zero. And in that trip from widespread carnage in whatever sport or endeavor you may, you know, be thinking about, down to zero, we can't do it. And as we try to get the state more and more involved in more and more protection of people from themselves, we're not going to get to zero, even though that is the goal of some healthcare professionals. And I would argue that the sort of disrespect that it engenders in the public for our governing bodies and institutions is not worth the trade-off. Thank you very much.
Questions of Mr. Lai?
Can I just, quick question?
By all means.
How can you explain to me how much of a, I don't know if you could, you would have to just describe this, why a helmet, particularly, I mean, I rode a sport bike, so I had a full helmet, but a lot of folks who ride, you know, more kind of Harleys or that type of bike, I see that you can wear a helmet that, you know, is a little less, I don't know, restrictive. How much of a burden is that? Is that really such a burden?
It certainly can be. It depends on what type of bike within those categories you choose to ride. I ride heavy cruisers and I tour, so it's about windshield height, setting up the wind so that it doesn't hit the helmet at a certain attitude or whatever the case may be. If you're riding without a windshield and with a helmet, you're going to be fatigued very rapidly. And on this long distance ride I took back, when, as Representative Glezio mentioned earlier, you do go, if you're going to ride for 38 years without a road accident, as is the case with me, you do automatically drop into a hyper-aware state. And the length of time that hyper-aware state can last is significantly shortened by the additional weight of the helmet and all that sort of thing, but the prudent rider, of course, when he reaches his limit, gets off the road, regardless.
Further questions? Thank you. For someone who is short on time, your remarks and sensitive to not being testifying often, you were just fine. We have a couple more. Troy Costales? ODOT.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales. I am the manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Here this morning in opposition to House Bill 2488, my testimony is a packet, and if you would bear with me for just a moment, I'd like to walk you through some of the information. It helps provide some of the background and also set some of the stage for the policy deliberations that you'll have. As was mentioned earlier, that in 1988 the referendum was passed by the citizens of the state by more than a 2-to-1 margin. It passed in every county of the state. The first attachment to my testimony is a question that we've been asking citizens of the state for a while now in relationship to the law requiring motorcycle helmets be worn, and track public opinion on that, because this issue comes before this body every 2 years, and so one of the things that we committed to was tracking what the public opinion was. And as you'll note, that for the past 5 years, it's been in the high 80% approval of maintaining the motorcycle helmet law in the state. As also was mentioned by Ms. Fisher and others, about we did not have a time period of a law. Prior to that, we had a law, then not. What I've attached for you in Attachment 2 is just giving you, in a bar chart format, the number of deaths in this state during those time periods. From 1968 through 1976, when we did have a law in this state with much fewer riders and more cyclists on the road, there was an average of 38 motorcyclist deaths each year during that time segment. During the time segment of 1977 to 1987, in the middle of that bar chart, when we did not have a helmet law, the number of deaths per year average jumped to 68. And then since 1988, when the law was reinstated by the vote of the people, including up through last year, that average has dropped back down to 31. Roughly a 50% change from when we had a law to when we did not have a law. One thing I like to mention is during that time period as well, the legislative body has enacted rider education programs, first for those under the age of 18 wanting to have an endorsement on their license to drive a motorcycle, required to go through a motorcycle training course sponsored and run by our office, and then later amended to those under the age of 21. And it's important to note, because as you move through in the packet, you'll see the fact that that age group has literally disappeared out of the fatality group, showing that education is having an impact and is reducing the deaths for those under the age of 21. Attachment 3 goes back through the last 25 years and just giving you an indication of, for the deaths that occurred during the time we did not have helmet law and since the referendum passed, you can see in the colors what the number of deaths that were unhelmeted versus the deaths that were helmeted. And after the referendum passed, you see the red area, which are the deaths with no helmets, has dropped to very small, one or two in a year compared to 25 or 30 per year during the time period of no helmet law. Attachment 4 in your packet, which is the line chart, is indicating the average age of death for motorcyclists in this state. And the reason why the line is going up is the average age of death for a motorcycle driver or passenger is increasing. And to turn one more page, attachment 5, the last item in your packet, is showing you the deaths for those under the age of 21, is the blue triangle line, and the deaths for those under the age of 18 are the pink and square line. And you can see how those numbers have dropped over the past few years, in part due to the training program, also in part due to the requirement of the helmet law. There were some questions brought up. That's one of the dangers of going last, or towards the end, is an expectation of answering questions, and so it would take a second to try and answer a couple of those. In relationship to insurance, is it required? Yes, that is a requirement, Madam Chair, for those that are on motorcycles. What are some of the extra things that they are required to do? To get an endorsement for a motorcycle on your driver license, you have a written as well as an on-vehicle test at DMV. If you have taken the state's motorcycle safety education course, known as Team Oregon, your graduate card that you receive once you've completed that course gives you waivers at DMV, and you do not have to take the additional DMV tests because the tests you've passed, written and on vehicle, are greater than what DMV would test you on. So it acts kind of like a third-party vendor for DMV and helps DMV out as well. Representative Witt asked a question about comparison to other states based on vehicle miles traveled. Getting vehicle miles traveled for the vehicle of motorcycles is very difficult, and most states do not do that. It is usually an estimate based on going out and doing some sort of visual check of how many vehicles are going down the road, which are different classifications, trucks, passenger cars, SUVs, and motorcycles. The only way, for the most part, comparing state to state, that you're going to find is valid is against population or fatality to injuries based on endorsements that they have to ride a motorcycle, or based on the number of registered motorcycles in the state. And those get a little loose. It's a little less direct of a comparison, but it's just based on the fact that the vehicle miles traveled, getting it specific to the motorcycling group itself, is difficult. And we'll send to the chair and to Ms. Fisher the information that we've got from other states through very likely 2003 on the measures that they do publish on a state-by-state basis. Also talked about other states, and I'd like to highlight for you four states recently in the United States that have taken away the mandatory helmet law and what has happened. In 1997, Arkansas and Texas repealed their helmet laws except for those under the age of 21. Helmet use was at 97% in both those states prior to the law being repealed. When the law was repealed, that Texas, their helmet use dropped to 66%, and in Arkansas it dropped to 52%. Their deaths following that law, the year after, Arkansas's fatalities increased 21%, and Texas fatalities increased 31%. Most recently, Kentucky in 1998 repealed their law for everybody except for under 21, and Louisiana repealed their helmet law for everybody except under the age of 18. Both states were at a near 100% helmet use prior to the repeal of the laws, and both states saw their helmet use dropped to 50%. In both states, the registered motorcyclists, however, at the same time, increased by 20%. The fatalities in both those states also increased. So in looking at those four states and what has happened very recently in relationship to repeal of their law based on an age factor, our current average of 31 fatalities per year in this state very likely will increase to 45 to 49, just using those other four states as an example, having the exact same situation debate that you're having here. In Oregon, we're very fortunate. We run a very comprehensive motorcycle safety program. It includes outreach to drivers of all vehicles. It includes training opportunities required for those under the age of 21, even though the average age of the student in that class is in the mid-30s. So a lot of people are taking that course. It includes testing standards for what DMV does test on those that don't take the course, and it includes a mandatory helmet law. Our fatalities and injuries have not gone up at the rate that the rest of the U.S. has experienced the last 4 or 5 years that have been in the press quite a bit, and it's in part due to our overall comprehensive program, and it's a partnership between the safety office, between Oregon State University, between all the various motorcycling organizations, and those that are present here. We're all part of making sure that this happens and that we do decrease the risk of fatality injury for the motorcyclists in our state. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to try and answer any of the remaining questions that you or the committee might have.
Go ahead.
Thank you for being here, sir. Thank you, Ms. Berger. You stated that motorcyclists are required to have insurance. Can you give us any idea at all how many of those insurance companies require the use of a helmet for coverage?
Madam Chair and Representative Sumner, given that the helmet is a requirement by law of the state, the insurance companies then would be able to ask you the question about whether a helmet was being worn or not in relationship to insurance coverage. They do the same in relationship to child safety seats and safety belts as well.
So likely the insurance company won't pay an injury claim if you weren't wearing the helmet?
Madam Chair and Representative Sumner, I can't answer that question. I've not heard anybody that has stated that because they weren't wearing a helmet that they were not covered by their insurance. I do know that there is a policy question within this body this year of a concern about insurance companies eliminating the riders and ability for individuals to ride motorcycles and not have them covered under their general liability automobile insurance, which is an issue, and agree that that should not be allowed, that it's a legal vehicle within the state and it should be covered by insurance.
Thank you.
Representative,
thank you for being here. A couple people have talked about the initiative in 1988, I believe, and you present this public opinion data. Does ODOT make public policy safety decisions based on public opinion?
Madam Chair, Representative Galizio, we use public opinion as a measure of performance. We tracking things such as people that their perception of drinking and driving, whether it's socially acceptable or unacceptable. We typically will gauge public opinion on new safety items, such as when the child safety seat booster law went in, about how people understand that and are they hearing about it, tracking things around speed limit. Do we make the policy choices using that data? No, we will make program choices as to whether to increase certain outreach in parts of the state or use a different method to get the information out in order for people to understand what the law is and how to comply. And in some cases, some of these measures are in part for you to also gauge in relationships to public opinion, because legislative body generally doesn't get into that other than some of the political polling type of things. But on programmatic, part of the reason why we do this is to share it with you as well, so you can see choices you've made as a legislative body, how is the citizens reacting to that or understanding the choices that they made.
Further questions? I have a quick one. In your attachment one, you said that residents of Region 5 were the more likely residents than other areas. Do you want to describe what Region 5 is, please?
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Apologize. That's Department of Transportation lingo. Didn't even think about that when we put this together for you. I was concentrating on the top. The Oregon Department of Transportation, through its Highway Division program, has set up 5 regions within the state and for areas of coverage. Region 1 is an area around the Portland metropolitan area. Region 2 is the North Coast down through Mid Valley into Lane County. Region 3 is the southern part of the state all along the coast. Region 4 is the very central slice of the state from border to border. And Region 5 is the eastern side of the state from Washington to Idaho and Nevada borders, which is it's the largest geographic region of the state, but the less populated region of the state. Thank you very much. I apologize.
Thank you. That's fine. Yes.
I'm sorry.
That's fine.
You mentioned that there is an attempt to alert or train or educate automobile drivers about their responsibility vis-a-vis motorcyclists. I wonder if you could talk about where that takes place and what it is. And also, I'm wondering what percentage of automobile drivers who pass a test to earn a license do you think are really capable of driving adequately?
Madam Chair, and Representative Galizio, to your first point in relationship to outreach to drivers, comes in multiple fashions. First, in the driver's manual, particularly for teens that are learning how to drive, there's an element in the driver manual relationship to other users of the road, pedestrians, bicyclists, motorcyclists, mopeds, and others. So there's a focus on that. For years, we've been operating under a Share the Road campaign, which is getting at people to understand what's out there. We have a mass media campaign using television where we do creation of the ads. We don't pay for airtime. We just public service announcement. We do radio. We also do quite a bit of bus boards on the sides or the tails, bus tails, in relationship to outreach and messaging. Recognition of motorcycles specifically. In 1999, this body moved teen driver education from the Department of Education to the Safety Division of ODOT, and we put in and plugged in a very strong component in relationship to awareness of motorcycles. And in fact, quite a few of the ABATE chapters provide education in the driver education classroom to teens learning how to drive. For a while there, actually more requests than they were able to handle initially when that came out. So there's a faceted outreach as best we can from a government agency without paying for specific advertising. We do the creation, and then it's up to the media to air that. To your second question in relationship to those that take the driving test and their ability to drive, there is a new performance measure that Motor Vehicles Division uses, which is related to safe drivers, and they're looking back over a three-year history, what percentage of people have a clean three-year history in relationship to accidents and convictions on their record. I do not have in front of me the exact percentage, but it is something that is being reported just down the hall to the Ways and Means Committee this week. And if you'd like, Representative, I can send you a little information to what that performance measure is and what the last few years has been, what they are calling a safe driver measure to check clean records of motor vehicle operators. It does include motorcyclists as well. It doesn't separate it out. If that's acceptable.
Yes. And, okay. And any information sent to Representative Galizio, please.
I'll run through Ms. Fisher.
All committee members. I have one more question. You were here earlier today, and gentlemen testified to the fact that when they get on their motorcycle, they know the dangers of this activity, in the sense that you've presented death statistics, and they feel they are making that choice, that they are taking the responsibility for that risk. What have you got? And I hear that argument, okay? But where I think the state has a compelling interest is sort of in the injury piece that is not reflected in your statistics, the people who are injured and then remain sort of within the system as a result of motorcycle accidents, and you have provided no statistics about that.
Madam Chair, our oversight in relationship to injuries in past hearings on this particular bill, one of the things that was brought up was that the injury information was unusable, and so on our particular presentation, so we did not go into that area. For the past few years, as far as injuries related to motorcyclists, on average, that number for the past 4 years has been about 350 individual motorcyclists are injured every year in traffic crashes, whether that's single vehicle all by themselves or whether that's involving another motor vehicle on the road. Representing just about 2% of all of the injuries statewide for all motor vehicle related crashes.
One other question. Have you got, and could you send us a glimpse of motorcycle registration and how it's gone in the last, since the helmet law, the 1988 law, how many motorcycles as a percentage of vehicles? In other words, it's my perception, certainly, that there are more motorcyclists out there. And I guess I'm looking for this statistic that points to how many more in relation to road. I don't know whether you want to relate it to road miles or cars or other registration or population, but some measure of the number of motorcycles.
Madam Chair, I can give you a couple of breaths up. During 1995 to 1999, there were an average of 63,000, from 1995 to 1999, 63,000 registered motorcycles in the state. In the year 2000, that was 71,000 registered motorcycles. And the latest year I have data for you is 2003. And in 2003, registered motorcycles are 86,000. In the past 4 years, there's been a 21% increase in the number of registered motorcycles in the state. There's a resurgence of, if you will, apologize for the title, but the baby boomers going back into motorcycling. You know, there's just a lot of people returning to motorcycling that had ridden in prior years.
I'd appreciate that. And also describe to me what a moped is from ODOT's point of view.
Madam Chair, we will do that.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Buckley.
Just one question. Thank you, Ms. Carlisle. Given the fact that so many baby boomers are doing the midlife return to riding, and given the chart on Amendment 4, is there any sort of program to address safety for folks my age? Anything that says, hey, buddy, check your eyesight. It's not what it used to be. Anything that the department is doing to address the fact that line keeps going up?
Madam Chair and Representative Buckley, there's a few things that happen there. We work in partnership with the motorcycle dealers around the state mm-hmm. to have them alert individuals that they know that are coming back into motorcycling and have not been riding for quite a while. And there are three levels of classes currently being offered through our working agreement with Oregon State University for the Team Oregon program. There's the beginning rider course, which is aimed at the under 21. However, anybody of any age can go in, but we do reserve the seats for under 21 since it's mandated. There's an intermediate course for those that have their own motorcycle and have a returning and have a certain level of skill that the beginning course would be too easy for them. And at the high end, there's an advanced rider training, which is held actually on two tracks, Southern Oregon and in Portland as well, for those that are current motorcycle riders and have been riding for quite a while that want some advanced type of training. So it's purposely marketed and out for those levels of individuals, but only the under 21 is mandated at this time.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you for your time.
We only have one more, in case anybody else wants to get on the list, Wayne Calkins.
Madam Chair, representatives. My name is Dwayne Cameron Calkins, and I'm a lifelong resident of this beautiful state of Oregon. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm also a proud Democrat. And I want you to know that this has brought me here today because I support this bill. And just like we would get up in the morning and make our choices of what we're going to do, whether that might be, you know, go to the local lottery place and decide that if we're going to put in a dollar in that video poker machine at lunch or something, or whether we decide we're going to go to the local liquor store and decide that we're going to purchase some alcoholic beverage. Of course, those two things that I just described are things that only adults can do. So with choices like that, again, I would think that prudent, educated adults, again, Oregon adults, that want to decide what they can do with their life should be able to make those choices. And helmets, I believe, are one of those choices. And we've heard testimony today. Excuse me, I take medication that dries out my mouth. We've heard testimony today that would indicate that motorcycles are a public burden. You know, you may deciding on what side of the issue you come up on that, but I think the greater issue is of as Oregonians and what we've represented in this state to the rest of this nation. You know, you heard prior testimony here also that the amount of deaths that have increased in other states since the helmet laws were repealed in that state, but then again, Madam Chair, you addressed that quite well, that also the amount of registration of motorcyclists have also increased at a great rate. And so again, that, you know, you might want to take that into your consideration when you're looking at those figures. There's not without a doubt, you know, you've heard a lot of testimony today about Team Oregon. I am a state officer of the state of Oregon. I'm also the treasurer for the 3rd Congressional District of the Democratic Party. I'm also the treasurer for the reelect Jim Robson campaign for House District 44. I'm also an elected precinct committee person. you've heard testimony about Team Oregon, and really that is one of the best feathers in our cap, of, and I say our cap, with the Abate of Oregon that was enacted in 1982. In fact, it was such a great program that the Department of Transportation did decide to take that over. A lot of us in this room are facilitators. We are the ones that actually teach these programs in the community colleges throughout the state. I've been motorcycling. I'm 48. I'll be 49 here in a couple of months. You know, I've been motorcycling, you know, before I actually had my license and everything. I got on a motor. My first motorcycle was when I was 12. I had to ride the railroad tracks because to get to where we were riding. And then, of course, when I turned 16, I got my endorsement. And it wasn't until later, you know, in the mid 70s, when I became involved with this Abate. Actually, it was much later than that, but that's when this Abate, you know, started. And so anyway, I know that the education that we're doing, the safety education that we're doing, and these Team Oregon classes have saved far many more lives than helmets do. And that it's the kids and the younger kids that are popping wheelies on their stingrays and the skaters that are doing their flip tricks and stuff that I can't, I didn't even do that when I was doing the skateboard when I was a kid, but these are the kids that we're trying to get them young and teach them right and educate them with safety, and not only educate them but educate the rest of the state of Oregon and the other drivers, and let them know the motorcyclists of Oregon are a valid constituency within this state, and that we have a right to be heard, and we have a right to be safe, and we have also a right to make our own individual choices. This is my first time testifying here, so I am a little bit nervous, but I think that I pretty much kind of covered what I had to say here.
I don't know what happens when you're 21 that makes 21 the age that was chosen for this, other than you in this society you're recognized as an adult. But if you and I were maybe not here and we were having a conversation, and you think about the kind of bikes that are available and the speeds they go, and when you're 21, 22, 23 years old, and it's a fantastic feeling to go really fast. I mean, I know, and not that I've done that, but I've gone over the limit. But would you be amenable, or do you think folks would be amenable if you raised the age? In other words, I'm looking around, and I don't know. I don't want to assume that you gentlemen and anyone is older than 21, but I'm just going to make a guess. And would you be amenable to increasing the age at which
I cannot speak for Bike Pack, but I'm sure that any type of negotiation possibly would be considered, maybe. But yeah, is that pretty loose or what?
Yeah. We hear that a lot, actually.
Yeah. Interesting.
Go ahead. One more question. Choice is the a key word that keeps coming up. How about the choice to ride barefoot? Should that be allowed?
Yes, my personal opinion. No, I wouldn't ride barefoot. I have at a camp spot where I just had to get from one camp spot to another. But no, I would not, as a educated, safety, adult. No, I wouldn't want to ride out in the public without shoes.
But should we? Would it be problematic to say in law that you must wear shoes or boots when you're riding a motorcycle? Would that be? Do you think that's a bad idea?
I believe that adults should be able to choose their, educated adults should be able to choose their own safety apparel.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you
very much for coming today. Members of the committee, with regard to this public hearing, there are two letters on your desks that we are accepting from folks who could not be here today, from John Powell of State Farm Insurance and Derek Staples, MD. So those will go into your packet as testimony or as letters. Ask you to read them. Before we... Yes, Representative Witt.
Madam Chair, with respect to one of those letters from the insurance industry, are you anticipating any witnesses that we could ask questions of?
Now is a good time to request such a thing, Representative Witt, and we will take that as a request that the insurance company come forward and offer testimony, since we will be having further testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anyone else that any members of the committee would specifically like to hear from?
Insurance companies? Because I think you brought up a very valid issue with respect to injuries and potential public responsibilities.
Okay. Anything further? Anyone? I would like to remind the members of the committee that we will be having further testimony on this bill on a Thursday evening meeting. That's February 17th, and there is an expectation that you will all be here. We will not be meeting in the morning because we will be hearing that testimony. I have had discussions with our committee administrator about the fact that if we have a lot of testimony, we will be doing a little something to limit time. We're basically asking for 3 minutes of testimony and a hook at four. it depends a lot on how many people have signed up to speak and intend to speak. I like to hear from the public, and I like to not make limits. But on the other hand, we want to have everyone's chance to speak when we're still awake and not going long into the night. So I would kind of ask that those who are preparing remarks try and keep them in that sort of 3 minutes range, and I hope not to have to do a hook if I think we can time it out and keep people talking and not limit them. It would be my first choice, but not knowing how many, that's sort of what we're looking at. Okay, without further questions, I'm going to close this public hearing on House Bill 2488. Thank you all for coming. Members of the committee, I request unanimous consent to allow Representative Buckley to vote on all the bills we moved today while he was testifying elsewhere. Without objection, so moved. Representative Buckley, how do you vote on House Bill 2154?
Aye.
How do you vote on House Bill 2155?
Aye.
How do you vote on House Bill 2125?
Aye.
Thank you, Representative Buckley. Thank you to the members of the committee, and we will see you all Thursday night. I'm closing this session of the House General Government Committee.
Late. So